This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 290 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Before we get started, I just wanted to say thank you guys so much for listening, whether this is the first time you're listening or the 290th plus, because we've had, well, even if you've listened to all the episodes, we've had all of our Facebook Lives with our after shows and our live after shows, and not so many on our public Facebook page, mostly in our group, and a few things from, you know, little overseas or Comic-Con or just not a lot, but mostly obviously on our show here and mostly in our Facebook group. So I just wanted to say thank you guys so much for joining our community, helping make our community amazing and so special and so positive. We appreciate you guys more than you will ever know.
And now on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along.
I can't.
We're doing two chapters this week, but we're going to start with chapter 10, entitled Granny Bacon's Gifts. And if they ain't bacon, I'm sad.
I have to say, someone tweeted, I think it was last week. It was between our last episode and when this goes up, which is Sunday. So I don't know the exact day, but there was a tweet. Someone, I'm guessing they're not a listener or a regular listener. Maybe they are, and I didn't know, and I just don't know, because we don't know you all by name, unfortunately. We'd like to. So someone tweeted in response to either one of our tweets about the Fiery Cross read-along or in response to someone else's tweet, either sharing our tweet or something like that. And I think it was in response to someone else's tweet. But the tweet that I'm talking about said something along the lines of, oh, my good Lord, the Outlander podcast is doing a Fiery Cross read-along and they're only on chapter 9. and along the lines of, they're basically, these are my words, not the tweeters. They're basically going just as slowly as it feels like you're reading in the book.
It's what we do. It's all about realism,
and
people.
Actually, no, it's not that bad. I think it's better with us. The only thing I think it's slow is that it's like one or two or three chapters, and it's only once a week that you're hearing us. But we have to balance two things, right? Number one, we need to have content, so we can't like rush, like super rush. Number two, we also have day jobs and commutes, and one of us has a Chile and a kitty, and one of us has only kittens. So all that stuff and more stuff and another podcast. But that's a whole other topic. So we have to get through it without overly rushing, because the content has to last us until the next season. Number one. Number two, there's also only so much we can handle at any one time, right, Sam?
as far as prepping. But also, you know, we just really want this to feel like you're reading The Fiery Cross.
So Summer's saying we wanted every book to feel like you're reading The Fiery Cross, because this is what we do every year long.
No. Those we want to savor. This one we want to feel like The Fiery Cross.
It was an article in The Scotsman, I think, and I shared it. Dang, that thing. Y'all like shared it and liked it and hearted it and exclamationed it. And
careful, this is about to get dirty.
It is not.
What else did they do?
It's not
to
that kind of show. First of all, this is, well, I can't. I guess we're not family friendly. We are marked as explicit.
That's because
not because we dropped trow or anything.
Trow. They could see that anyway. It's a podcast.
My point is not because we do anything like drop trow dirty, or not that that's dirty, but whatever. We don't do anything extremely explicit, but if you have read Outlander, and you probably have if you're here for this read along, Diana does not shy away from describing things. And while we don't narrate the books, and while we don't read long passages and give descriptions of things, normally,
I may.
Things, topics, not even just like necessarily explicit, like, you know, lines or
things,
or descriptions.
Or things.
Huh?
Things.
What things?
Describing things. It's the my euphemism.
Male thing?
For anything.
Okay.
You get hung up on nipples.
Dude, that was an Outlander. Calm yourself. That was like 5 years ago. Stop. She can't get over this. Anyway, but you guys have all said I've gotten better. Not that much better, but a little bit better. Anyway, so I'm like digressing from my digression from my digression. Basically, we're still thankful for you, but that was my earlier chat.
Are we killing time because we're waiting for a guest to join us?
I'm not trying to vamp.
Are you vamping?
I'm not vamping. Chuck, 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 chuck. That was a really bad vaudeville horror. What do you call it? Not even vaudeville, excuse me. That was like
oompapa.
Yeah, but that was like bad, carny. Circus, bad, gross. Sorry, that was really bad.
Are you like playing one of those word games with yourself?
I guess.
Like catchphrase.
So basically, we are for the most part family friendly. I mean, the topic, just because it's a diet, they are Diana Gabaldon novels and they are Starz TV shows. They are obviously not meant for kids. And sometimes as we talk about either a subject matter or literal, you know, words to describe things, as Summer has said, our language, our vocabulary may be explicit.
Oh, mine's salt. I'm salty.
Exactly. We don't set out to be explicit. It's just it's Diana and Starz. How can you help it?
Speak for yourself.
So I don't know where I was going with this.
No one does.
So there was this article by the Scotsman that we shared that got like all kinds of like y'all were like hot to trot for that article, and not even just us, but a lot of people shared it. It was an interview with Diana when she was on her recent trip to Scotland. The quote was, and I had to read it because I'm like, I am not going to quote this and get this wrong and have Outlander fans all up my June because I do not want to. So I had to make sure that I was not misreading and I was not misunderstanding. According to this article, Diana said that there would be 2 more books after book 9. There's kind of a caveat. It's kind of a caveat, though. First of all, she doesn't mean 2 more books and then she's stopping writing. No. She was talking about it in relationship to the big books. We all know that. If you're a longtime fan or you've read her, you've known about Diana and you know kind of the parlance of Outlander fandom. They're the big books and bulges, right? So the big books are, there are now 8. The 9th is scheduled to, or we're told it's going to be out this year. In this article, she said, after book 9, she believes there will be 2. Now, she has said up until this article, to the best of my knowledge, because we can't read and cover everything, that there would be 10 in the 10 big books in this Jamie Clare main series, Jamie Clare et al. So to hear that there were 2 was like, excuse me, what? So this is the first that I've heard of a possible 11. But as I said, along with that statement, she said one will be the prequel about Jamie's parents, Brian, and my name is Ellen, to be about how they met, like that love story. So yes, I was kind of shocked, or like, oh, wait, what? I guess because it's still in the Jamie and Claire et al. Universe, it can definitely be, depending on the length, of course, it could be considered a big book, like a pre-big book, big book. I don't know. At first, I got like, oh my gosh, it's going to go on longer. And then I was like, oh, well, if it's Jamie and Claire's parents, excuse me, Jamie's parents, this is nothing new, right? She's talked about this for years.
Tangentially, she's never said she was going to do it. Huh. Just like I'm pretty sure your article that you read that gave you Agita didn't mention the What Frank New book either.
No, that's true.
So let's not put all of our biscuits in that particular chicken basket.
Wow, that is a new little idiom. I haven't heard that before. A new take on that.
Pretty sure I made it up.
With that, like I had to like simmer down, Ginger. It is. Or exhale, or as Summer says, breathe, bitch.
I do.
She does. It doesn't look like actually much has changed, except that maybe it's more confirmation that we're, or actually a confirmation that we're going to get the Brian and Ellen prequel. We don't know what she's going to consider it, but the fact that she said two more makes me think she's considering it a big book. So hopefully it's nice and big and fat like the other Ellender ones. That would be amazing. It's during the 1715 rebellion. The Jacobite Rebellion. So it'll be heavy history like most of Diana's stuff is. So it shouldn't be light reading.
I hate you right now because you don't ever pause long enough after statements where I could very easily interject that's what she said, because
stop it.
You said something specifically about afraid. A big fat long one. And then you barreled, and if you go back and when you go back and listen to this, you can hear me try to interject, and you just trained right over me like you didn't even hear me.
Stop. Okay,
clearly didn't, but it was a ruined moment.
I didn't mean to barrel over that. I was trying to, well, I talk fast kind of sometimes. You already mentioned thing, and you said you like granny bacon. No, you said you wanted bacon.
I said I was hoping one of her gifts would be bacon, but I've read the chapter and we are all going to be disappointed.
Unless you're vegetarian, then you're disappointed it's not veggie bacon, which is also sometimes
tasty. No one is ever disappointed it's not veggie bacon, I promise.
Oh, unless you're a vegetarian. Claire is closing up shop for the day for the gathering. Oh, by the way, number what day is it?
It's still that day.
That last day of the gathering.
Still the last day together.
This is like the longest day of our podcast. Gosh. So what you need to do, by the way, I can't promise we will because we're going to be going further, obviously, is once we've, according to Michael M., I think, the gathering does not end until chapter 17. I don't know. I haven't memorized how the rest of the chapters fall and like how they clump. Or how they're grouped. It could be 3 more weeks. It could be 4 more weeks. It could be, I doubt 5. Probably another month, max.
Of us on the last day of the gathering?
Yeah. My point was, once we got to the last day of the gathering, we should tell someone. We should announce to Twitter. Have a special tweet. Maybe even a special Facebook post and say, hey, y'all, if you want to start the read-along now, you can either start with our next episode, which is chapter 18 after the gathering, or you can binge chapters 1 through 17 because we're done. Okay, so Claire is closing up shop on this still the last day of the gathering. We find out that Murray, her competitor / fellow doctor, whatever, is practicing Bree's charm and dipping the instrument in boiling water, his flame. So yay for fake charms or real charms, whatever. Lucky charms.
That was last week.
I know, we're a little bit late. Actually, that's true. We didn't even include. Yeah, happy belated St. Patrick's Day, y'all. Martina P. writes, how so very clever of Claire and also Brianna in a previous chapter to incorporate their lessons of sanitation and hygiene into some sort of prayers. This is exactly the correct manner to get the Highlanders' attention and subsequent conformance. When about to leave the pop-up clinic for the day, actually, Martina, it's the last day, so no more. Claire observed how Murray
was... We'll see
about
that. These days tend to go on and on and on.
Not our last day, Summer. Claire's last day.
I know.
Oh. Claire observed how Murray was taking the time to perform the ritual of the fleam, dipping it into boiling water and sterilizing the instrument. Very smart ladies. These few lines once again demonstrate how Claire is in her element when she is healing and helping her patients. It is such an essential part of her, and she never tires, regardless of how many hours she puts in. Payment for her services are never on her mind. Well, about never. She will never not treat someone due to that. She doesn't put services before payment before services. But she's said a few times in the last few chapters how, you know, last guy in the last chapter, or was it in this one? I think it was the last chapter where someone had paid her in coin and she like jingle jangled her pocket. So, she's very aware of it, but she would never not treat someone because they didn't have a specific type of payment or even maybe any payment. Claire is going on her own little way, said, blessed is this for blah, 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 blessed is this. So I just wrote, she is full of blesseds. Basically, eat your greens, wipe your arse, boil water, and when 7-year-old when 7-year-old Eglantine Bacon and her sister Pansy find her. They have brought Claire a present from their Granny Bacon. It was a mob cap with lace and ribbon. And it's twofold. It's a gift.
It's yes. Glorious.
Officially, it's in thanks for the meds that were sent to her. But also, it's Granny getting her way.
I really want this in the series.
Oh, please. Then Claire tells us about Granny. She'd met her a few months earlier, and Granny had been visiting Farquhar Campbell's mother. She didn't like that Claire went around uncovered or hatless. And Claire had laughed at any comments about her not wearing a hat or anything and had given her her meds. And it was some of Jamie's second best whiskey. Little Eglantine urges her to put the cap on. Quote, Granny tells us to be sure you put it on so as we could tell her how it suited you. Unquote. Uh-huh, sure. So she puts it on, and the two young girls clapped, delighted. Megan P. writes, it is really cool that Claire can make such a huge impact on her environment. People really were so clueless to health matters that are basic knowledge in Claire's time. I find it wholly appropriate that a woman named Granny Bacon would be quite the memorable and interesting character. I looked up mob cap because I wanted to see some examples. I found the definition and a picture. I found the origin to be particularly interesting. So mob cap is according to, I think she didn't give us, she gave us a link to an image she found. I don't know that she gave us a link to the definition or description. I can look one up, but she writes, or she quotes, a large soft hat covering all of the hair and typically having a decorative drill worn indoors by women in the 18th and early 19th centuries. The origin, mid 18th century mob. It's a variant of obsolete mab or mob, which means slut. The word mob was first used in the sense of prostitute. In the mid to late 17th century, later it was used to denote a negligee. Megan concludes or finishes with, I don't know how a negligee made its way to an ugly cap, but oh well. You know, I know exactly how a negligee made its way to an ugly cap. A woman or women had a negligee on and the guys were like, yeah, that's great. Just put it on your head because I don't want you covered up. That's how. No, but on your face, just on your head. Okay. Elizabeth K. writes, Granny Bacon has found a perfect solution to getting her way.
Can we talk about a mop cap, though, for a minute?
Yes.
I'm desperately trying to imagine how this could ever be construed as a slutty hat, unless it was the only thing they were wearing.
It probably was because they took the negligee off and put it on their head. And then they were even more slutty because they were now naked, walking around with only hats on.
But they started as slut hats, and then they later became a lingerie.
No, it was other way around.
You said it started as a slut cap and then later became.
No, I don't know how a negligee made its way to an ugly cap.
No, go back further from that. Before that.
Origin, mid-18th century, mob. Mm-hmm. The word mob is a variant of obsolete mab, which means slut. The word mob was first used in the sense of prostitute. So that was mid-18th century. Mid to late 17th century, which is earlier, later denoting a negligee. So mid to late 17th century, which is 1600s, denoting or later than mid to late, denoting a negligee. So they're kind of going backwards in time. Mid-18th century, it was associated with the word slut or prostitute.
So they literally wrote that entry just to confuse me.
I guess so.
Cool. Cool, cool. Let's go.
Elizabeth K. writes, Granny Bacon has found the perfect solution to getting her way, even if only for a few minutes. Granny uses her granddaughters to perfection. Of course, Claire is going to put the cap on. What kind of monster would say no to two tiny faces? The mental image of Claire wearing this mob cap with it hanging down over her eyes and the ribbons brushing her cheeks is so amazing. The scene may not be important enough to make it into the show, but how great would it be to see Katrina wearing this ridiculous hat? It would be great. Martina P. writes, I really would like to meet Granny Bacon, who seems to have an excellent sense of humor. She gives Claire two very different gifts. the giant mob cap, which any respectable woman of Claire's age should possess and wear. This gift is old-fashioned and a symbol of propriety, while the second gift, either Daoka or Daoka seeds for birth control, signify a very modern and forward-thinking gesture. Huh. I think Granny Bacon wants Claire to be respected by the community, hence the mob cap, and admires her professional skills and calls her a conjure woman, hence the seeds that are under no circumstances to be discussed with menfolk.
I want to talk about the seeds.
We will. Timing could not have been better, considering the earlier conversation with Brianna. Bring ourselves to the seeds. Claire gives each of the little girls a sweetie and then is about to take the cap off when she sees the girl's mother. Granny Bacon did have another gift for Claire, after all. Given to her through the girl's mother, it was a parcel of tiny seeds that she didn't recognize. The girl's mother, I didn't write down her name, did tell her that the indigenous called them Daoko. Or Daoko. The drawing on the parcel, it was, I believe it, a paper parcel, had been of a plant, and the plant seemed familiar to Claire. But she learns from that Granny's own granny was a Catawba medicine woman. So what was the use of the herbs? To stop a woman from getting with child. She instructs a teaspoon a day in a glass of water, and Claire thanks her.
So are we talking like chia seed type seeds, or are they like apple seed type seeds? And can you
ingest
them?
I think they're more like chia.
But do they work if you just ingest them, or do you grind them? Or
I think you just, she didn't say, did she? She just said, take them, swallow them.
Uh-huh.
I believe, and we're going to get more, I think we're going to get more into that, but I believe they are Queen Anne's lace seeds. And another listener gave us some links, but you can definitely Google those and read about them. They had been used by indigenous populations to prevent pregnancy. So just before we get to the next reader's comments, quote, the average woman, Polly. Polly is the girl's mom who gives her the seeds from Granny Bacon. The average woman of Polly's age might have 5 or 6 children. She had the 2 girls and lacked the drained look of a woman worn with ill-timed bearing. Evidently, the seeds worked, unquote. So she thinks it's definitely a well-timed gift given her recent, or remember the same day, conversation with Brianna. So yeah, evidently the seeds work. Elizabeth K. writes, after listening to the Outlander podcast for years, I got curious about the seeds Granny Bacon sent Claire. On previous readings, I didn't think much about it and just went on with the story. I was rather surprised to discover that Daoko seeds are Queen Anne's lace. There was a big patch of Queen Anne's lace growing under my childhood bedroom window, so we often had it in the house because I would pick them for my mom. Having grown up with modern medicine, I don't often look at plants and think about what uses they might have. I wouldn't trade modern medicine for herbal lore, but it's fascinating to me how people were able to discover medicinal uses for plants throughout history. Who first looked at Queen Anne's lace and thought, I wonder what would happen if I swallowed those seeds? If anyone really wants to know more, this website, and she shares a website that has very in-depth section on the seeds and the science behind their use. So yeah, they seem to have science behind their use. And that is carrotmuseum.co.uk. We will share that in our show notes.
That sounds like a porn then, site.
Summer. Carrot Museum?
Uh-huh.
Oh, stop it. And then she also shared a leak. She did not leak. she shared a link, a Wikipedia link to their article on the Catawba people. And we'll share that in our show notes as well. And briefly from that article about the Catawba people. So this is Granny Bacon's ancestors. The basic information they had was as follows. Quote, the Catawba, also known as Issa or Issa, Essa or Iswa, but most commonly Iswa, that means people of the river, are a federally recognized tribe of Native Americans known as Catawba. What?
Are you reading verbatim off the page, or are you actively trying to figure out how to say it?
No, I'm reading verbatim. Okay. Stop it. Make me sound like an idiot.
Me?
I'm having fun, Summer. Stop it. Are a federally recognized tribe of Native Americans. Stop.
Okay.
What?
Nothing. Good.
Known as the Catawba Indian Nation. They live in the southeastern United States on the Catawba River at the border of North Carolina near the city of Rock Hill, South Carolina. They were once considered one of the most powerful southeastern Siouan-speaking tribes in the Carolina Piedmont, as well as one of the most powerful tribes in the South as a whole. The Catawba were among the East Coast tribes who made selective alliances with some of the early European colonists when these colonists agreed to help them in their ongoing conflicts with other tribes in the region. During the American Revolutionary War, the Catawba supported the American colonists against the British. Decimated by colonial smallpox epidemics, warfare, and cultural disruption, the Catawba declined markedly in number in the late 18th and 19th centuries. Some Catawba continued to live in their homelands in South Carolina, while others joined the Choctaw or Cherokee, at least temporarily. Terminated as a tribe by the federal government in 1959, in 1973, they established their tribal enrollment and began the process of regaining federal recognition. In 1993, their federal recognition was reestablished along with a $50 million settlement by the federal government and state of South Carolina for their long-standing land claims. The tribe was also officially recognized by the state of South Carolina in 1993. Their headquarters are Rock Hill, South Carolina. Now, as of 2006, the population of the Catawba Nation has increased. This is very sad. Increase. It's good to be an increase, but these numbers are very sad. Has increased to about 2,600. Most in South Carolina, with smaller groups in Oklahoma, Colorado, Ohio, and elsewhere. So Claire, as she was, and I mean this in a very sweet and joking way, before Claire was ambushed, right, by those children, she was on her way to take, she had already broken down her clinic for the day / the gathering and was going back to their camp. And she hears the words, Stephen Bonnet. That'll stop you in your tracks. It had been said by Jamie, who was chatting with Hayes. Their conversation stopped when she arrived. Lieutenant Hayes was there and he takes his leave. Good timing, Hayes. Jamie tells Claire he'd asked Hayes about where Bonnet was. She insists, this is my business. And Jamie says, quote, is it not sense to know where danger may lie? Unquote. She begs Jamie to leave him alone, meaning like leave this Bonnet. Just don't even go out. Don't ask about him. Don't pursue it at all. He tells her that he's asked. this is so I can't say it's just like a man because I don't know this, but it sounds just like a man. OK, so Claire is begging him, please just leave him alone, because all she knows right now is that she heard him talk to Hayes about Bonnet. That's all she knows. And how does he reply? He goes, he tells her that he's asked throughout the gathering all week long of men for all over. And don't worry, there's no report of him anywhere in North Carolina. She's not very happy with that, though. She's not happy that he'd been hunting Bonnet for so long and not even said anything to her.
Oh, he wasn't going to say anything to her now. She exactly. Just happened to overhear it.
He happened exactly. And he still is not promising to stop looking, but he forces the issue. Quote, you say it's your business. I know it's mine. Are you with me then? Unquote. She pulls him around so he's facing her and looking at their family. She tells him, they are your business and mine. Hasn't Stephen Bonnet done enough damage to them, to us? He pulls her close and says, quote, I let him go. And evil came of it. Can I let him wander free, knowing what he is and that I have loosed him to spread ruin? Unquote. I mean, what do you say to that? I don't know. I mean, you still say, yeah, I get it, but let's not increase the possibility of us getting into more trouble with that dude. They discuss where Jamie's duty lies. Is it doing away with Bonnet, or is his duty... Does his duty lie with their family?
We need a new word for duty. It's been ruined.
Oh, Summer. There is danger in hunting, and he knows this. But she is wanting him to face the possibility of something happening to them, meaning the rest of their family or someone in their family, if something happened to him. And Jamie, just like a man, or at least just like Jamie, assures her that nothing will happen. And I wrote, really, Jamie? Really? Have you been through the last four books?
Has he read any of his own stories?
Have you read any of his stories? Have you read any of Gabaldone?
She likes to torture her men.
She puts you... It's her fault you were in there with... what's his nuts?
Blackjack.
BJ, yeah. It's all her. Fergus, seeing them kiss... I mean, they are not being romantical. Just put it that way. Seeing them kiss, shouts, "Encore!"
Yeah, but they didn't kiss. He planted one on her. That's not the same thing.
No, exactly. But Fergus doesn't see that. All he sees is they are, it looks like they're kissing. And Claire's like, "No, not encore."
Think about the situation. Claire's the only one with a face full of anger, right? Because she's the only one mad. Jamie is like unfazed at all. So all they see is his unfazed, not angry face. So, and she's like turned upstage looking at him. So her back is to everybody. So they don't see the angry face. If they'd seen Claire's face and not Jamie's face, they would not have encored that.
They would not have encored that. Shiz. Claire says, "Not encore. I don't want to hear the name of Stephen Bonnet ever bloody again." And he assures her with, "It will be all right. Trust me, Sassenach." Really? Jamie, dude. Martina P. writes, "Claire and Jamie are having a heated discussion about Stephen Bonnet under the pretense of a very romantic moment when Jamie pulls Claire very close for a kiss." Gosh, I can visualize this scene so well, Martina says. Jamie and Claire have very different approaches. Claire wants to avoid danger altogether, and Jamie wants to confront it. While Claire is definitely not a coward, she knows what a dangerous man Stephen Bonnet is, and that Jamie is risking his life and also others. This is Ginger. I'm putting that in there. When hunting him. She is no longer alone and has the choice of returning to the stones if, God forbid, something would happen to Jamie. This option is no longer available now. They have responsibilities for Brianna, Roger, and Jemmy. Jamie is a man of his time and thinks Bonnet was able to do all this damage to his family because he let him free, and now it is his duty to kill him.
I mean, he did.
He did. He did. That's true. And finally, Martina closes with, "I trust Jamie and would follow this man into a burning stable, but I am with Claire on this one." I think most of us are with Claire on this one.
I mean, it's like Claire has finally seen a little bit of light, you know, in the fact that being as brazen and as forthright and as buck the system as she's been is not safe and has not maintained safety for her family. And I think I know because I've read the other books that it's not going to last, but this is probably the most reserved we're ever going to see Claire.
Megan P. writes, "Moving on. I found Claire's statement about the likelihood of crossing paths with Bonnet, again, ironic. She says there's a slim chance. We all know DG's books by now. We will definitely cross paths with Bonnet again. I have no doubts, but I do see both sides of Jamie and Claire's argument about seeing him again. I think Claire needs to be more wary, though, because Bonnet's character is totally unpredictable. Definitely an interesting chapter with good conversation and character development."
That was chapter 10. And moving along to the second chapter we will be reviewing this evening, chapter 11, entitled Pride.
Wait, we're going to be reviewing? I didn't know we did. Are we reviewing?
Isn't that what you always do?
I don't know.
Book,
I mean,
your little book reports.
My book reports. Summer, stop it. I thought they were discussions. It's a read along, so we discuss the chapters and people give us their thoughts if they want.
I mean, we're not thumbs up, thumbs downing it. It's not going to get stars and ratings. I didn't say we're rating
well,
it.
I'm thumbs downing, down thumbing, fingering. I'm just kidding. I'm not.
No, you're not.
I am thumbs downing Jamie in the last chapter. You, me, and Martina. We got our girl band. Okay.
Girl band.
Susanna M. writes, "I believe pride here refers to a lot of characters in this chapter. Joan Finley, who would rather live in total poverty than accept charity. She may not have money to all her household, but she has her pride. Ian Moore is the best example. He suffers with his physical condition with pride. Roger, who will not accept Jocasta's insinuations or her money, and Jocasta, who just was called Jocasta." Look, it's going to happen. It has. Marsley, Marsali, it's going to happen. Jocasta is the most proud of all and probably the one who has lost the most. She tries to exercise her power and exhibits her money all around, but all she is trying to do is compensate her loss with her pride.
She needs to work on her subtlety. That's her biggest issue.
Oh, Jocasta?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Dude. Okay, so chapter. Roger has just finished with the Findleys, so basically where we left him in chapter 9. And is thinking on her children. Joan likely had had two husbands and was once again a widow. He considers using this as evidence to share with Bree that, quote, oh, Lord, I couldn't even finish the sentence before I rolled my eyes. He considers using this as evidence to share with Brianna that, quote, marriage and childbirth were not necessarily mortal to women. Were not necessarily mortal to women, unquote. Yeah, maybe let's not. Okay, Roger, let's not. Keep it in your head. He also thinks of Ian Vore. He's perhaps 30. He wonders how he survived so long in times like these and realized, remembering back, that he had seen his family come out and help him feed him and wipe his face and everything, that it was his family who'd cared for him. And this makes him think of himself and his own family. And he remembers Joan's words, send them safe home. There'd been talk about the regulation, but he thought because the topic hadn't made it into history books that it must not have come to anything too important. But if it did, he promises himself to do his best to keep the two younger men away from danger. He heads to Jocasta's camp. She'd basically brought half of River Run. It was all done up. Thinking of the rich meal he and Bree had shared at Jocasta's, quote, the contrast between the lavishness and the recent poverty of the Findlay encampment were too much to be borne with complacence, unquote. As he goes into Jocasta's, he finds her alone, save for Fedra. And Jocasta knows right away who it is. And then before I share my next lines that I wrote, my own comment is, ugh, the thing that people said, oh my gosh, Ginger, I never noticed it. Well, I didn't notice it either. And now this thing will not go away. It's once you see it and you know it, it's everywhere. Okay, quote, I heard, this is Jocasta greeting him. Quote, I heard your step and then I smelt the blood on you. The wound's come open again, has it not?
It's like Hemingway in the rain.
Uh-huh. And then, quote, his fingers went involuntarily to the gash at his throat. He'd forgotten it entirely in the rush of the day's events, unquote. So Jocasta took the cleaning cloth from Fedra and tended to his wound herself. And then she put some of Claire's lavender and golden seal ointment on his wound. And he tells her about the Findleys. And she confirms his suspicion that Joan's husband, so her third, had died. But he says, like, he wants to help her, but Joan will not take charity. As Jocasta thinks about this, Roger notices one of Bree's mannerisms. Jocasta cocks her head to the side when thinking. That was a cute observation. She says, how about this? Okay, after the wedding feast, where everyone will eat and be fat and sassy, we'll have some food. There'll be plenty of food. We'll have some food made up to them. And the excuse will be, or the reason will be, look, we're giving it away to a lot of people. If you guys don't take it, it will spoil. So they believe that will get them to take some food. And then she thinks of extra bits of clothing and material, and they're to make a bundle and also slip in 10 shillings. And they will give this bundle to Father Donahue, who will give it to Joan. So they think there's a lot better chance that she would take something from a priest. Fedra had been sewing Bree's stomacher when Jocasta had asked her to go start making this bundle. And Roger gets a look at it. He thanks her and makes as if to leave, but Jocasta's not done. No, no, no.
Did you just treat Jocasta like she was your cat?
I'm sorry, Kitty. No, Summer.
That was your cat voice.
No, no, no. Maybe Jocasta was treating Roger like my cat. So, oh, I'm sorry, baby. I just flicked her on the nose. I'm sorry, Boba girl.
Now that's how you should treat Jocasta.
Flick her on the nose.
Uh-huh.
She's blind. That's terrible.
Oh, get her my attention. Gosh. It's
she can already like tell who's there by smelling their wound at their throat. Yet she don't need to get her attention. You're
maybe
horrible. summer. Okay. You guys, if you ever have any blind friends or sight.
Don't flick them on the nose. That's not nice.
No, that's not what I was going to say. Of course, don't do that too. Don't do that either. Never invite summer over.
I wouldn't do that.
You just said. You just suggested I do it to a blind woman, even though she's fictional.
No, what I suggested was that you had how you treat your cat flipped with how you should treat Jocasta.
Whoa, what accent are you having now?
I don't know. It's gone.
It's gone until it's not. Okay, so apropos of nothing, well, I guess apropos of money and lavishness and money in general, she brings up the whole heiress thing. She's like, you know, I meant to make Bree my heiress. Well, I changed my mind. It's going to be Jem. He's like, record scratch. What? What?
God, she says, just can't stop.
She won't stop. Quote, I wouldn't involve lawyers more than I must. I think it is always a mistake to go to the law. Do you not agree, Mr. McKenzie? Roger realizes he was being insulted and warned. She thought he was after Bree's inheritance, potentially. She says she likes Roger well enough and recognizes that Jamie does as well. But she's got to protect her own. Oh my gosh. She relays that no one at the gathering knows of his Mackenzie line. And among Scots, of course, as we have been reminded over the past number of chapters at this gathering, which the last day we're still on, if you don't know your family or a person's ancestry among Scots, that's a big thing. That's a big deal. And then she adds with a pat to his hand, quote, Brianna will have the use of the money, of course, until we Jeremiah should come of age. Unless anything should happen to the child, that is. Unquote. Dang, Jocasta. But she says, if something were to happen to Jemmy, everything would go to her nephew, Hamish. Now, if you remember from last chapter from our last episode, which is chapter 9, we find out that Hamish, son of Colum, but really son of Dougal, of Leah.
Wow.
I forgot to put the ending on the word. Sorry.
I heard.
That was aggressive.
That was really aggressive.
So Hamish is still alive. And if anything happens to Jemmy, then Jocasta will make Hamish her heir. He actually is the backup already. She had her documents and her lawyers changed of it. So this is how it is right now. It's Jemmy. And if anything happens to him, it's Hamish. So she's like doing double, triple time to make sure Roger is not going to get his hands on any of this of her money. She says she apologizes for any offense she's offered. Quote, I thought it would be as well, though, for you to know what was in my mind. Unquote. And then, quote, for Jeremiah and Brianna, perhaps, lad, even for you. Unquote. Those be ominous words. She knows what's what. If you can't love him for his sake, maybe you could for his prospects. She begins to speak again, and Roger cuts her off with, Madam, I do not want your money. My wife does not want it, and my son will not have it. Cram it up your hole, aye? Susan M. closes this chapter out with, It is very interesting to mention that this chapter is about the immortal sin and the next is called virtue. Can pride be seen just as a mortal sin? Is it just a terrible emotion? The philosopher Aristotle separates this emotion into a good and a bad. The bad side of this emotion is the mortal sin, when one shows overconfidence or arrogance. And the positive notion is that a noble person has nobility and goodness of character. He doesn't think he is better than others. He just thinks of himself worthy of good things. This is a very short chapter, but it looks like an iceberg. There is so much more going on under the surface. We all know Roger is a good and honorable man, and in this chapter, he begins to feel more self-confident in this century. When he comes across Joan Finley, he decides he wants to help. He can't see a woman in distress. And does this bring him trouble? I don't know. He decides to take action to help Joan without going to Jamie first. That's interesting. That's a good observation. He doesn't want to trouble Jamie, knowing that he has his own money problems at the moment. When Jocasta starts to question Roger's character and motivations to marry Brianna, I believe she's preparing him a trap. she is manipulating him. Jocasta could just have told Roger she was leaving River Run to Jemmy and leave it at that. Roger would be free to draw his own conclusions about it. But she is a Mackenzie, and she was trying to get a certain reaction. Remember that Jamie always calls the Mackenzies sly as foxes. I had to look that one up in the original books. Her accusations against Roger just get more offensive with each sentence. She wants him to explode and wants it to happen in a very public place. She wants to shut up all gossipers. She wants to shut all the gossipers' mouths about this marriage. Notice that she doesn't seem surprised about his violent reaction to what she is telling him. What I found funny was that he was thinking he was going to decline Jocasta's offer to receive River Run with much more grace than Brianna. Nope. But I was really proud of Roger for standing up for himself and his family, even though I believe he was trapped into it. Another funny moment is when Jocasta is asking Roger about his family. She says, no one at the gathering knows anything about him or his family. Wouldn't it be hilarious if he had said, of course you don't. I'm from the future and a direct descendant of your brother Dougal, auntie. Yes, that would have been awesome, actually. Very good insights, Susanna. I think Susanna, but you wrote Susan, about Roger going to Jocasta without going to Jamie first. And also about, what did you think, Summer? Did you think of that as maybe a trap or doing something to get him to have a public reaction?
Okay, I hear what you're saying. I think that's an extra added layer that I don't think.
Okay, well, I thought it was a very interesting observation.
It's an idea. I just think that that's a little more thought than I would have put into it. Because I don't think Jocasta cares so as much what other people think. Because she doesn't have to. Because she's got money. So while she cares about societal things, about Brianna looking like she got married before the baby was born and things like that, I don't think Roger's, what's the word, reputation is that high on her list. I mean, I think that she's doing this for her own reasons so that she can gauge his reaction. I don't think she cares.
About others?
That much, yeah. But that's just me. I mean, that's the beauty of reading. We all get to have our own interpretations of what we read. So, and that was chapter 11. Join us next week and we will be moving forward with our The Fiery Cross read-along with chapter 12 entitled Virtue. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you go to www.outlanderpod.com/fierycross. It's really weird to say it without the in front of it. And if you go there, there will be a link to our spreadsheet where you can see the available chapters. And if you message me or put a message on the event page, just tag me or tag Pod and let us know what chapters you'd like to be assigned.
And of course, to continue the conversation, because, I mean, there's a lot of books and a lot of people and a lot of shows and all music and oh my gosh, and interviews and all the things. We will talk anything, pretty much anything and everything Outlander in our Facebook community. And you can join us if you haven't already at outlanderpod.com/group. And as always, thank you guys so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.